Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, our first guest today says that if you replace most of your lawn with native plants, you will welcome the insects and birds that you're sure to attract. Danae Wolf, our guest, a wildlife photographer, educator, founder of the community conservation initiative called Chasing Bugs. And she's the author of a handy new guidebook. It's titled Grass Isn't Greener, the Everyday Conservationist Guide to Bringing Nature to Your Yard. Danae's with us to share some of the changes you can make to your lawn or garden that are going to make a big difference for the environment. So, do you want a wildlife-friendly habitat? Do you want to attract pollinators and get rid of invasive plants? Those are some of the things we'll talk about with her today in our part of her book. You can join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Danae Wolf, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Larry. I'm super excited to be here.
And your book is just out as of yesterday?
As of yesterday, yeah. Brand new on the bookshelf.
Brand new on the bookshelf. Well, before you're writing your book, you spent many years photographing insects in particular, and you created a community conservation initiative called Chasing Bugs. Tell us about that, just to begin.
Yeah, so I don't want to tell my whole life story, but it does start when I was pretty young. When I was about 12 years old, I got really interested in photography, specifically photographing sort of macro images of flowers and other plants. And hated insects, by the way, my entire childhood. Not just hated, but like really loathed. I hated bugs, spiders especially. I had really severe arachnophobia. And things kind of hit this point when I was actually around 20 years old. I was in college, still photographing plants, but my parents bought me my first macro lens and popped that onto my camera for the first time. And now all of a sudden I can be up close and personal photographing all those flowers that I had spent the last 10 years photographing. And I started to notice this whole new world. And that was this world of bugs that I had never really noticed before. At the same time, I was in college getting my undergraduate degree in environmental studies. So I was learning about ecology, local ecology in particular, and sort of the intersection of my interest in macro photography and then that degree in environmental studies just opened up this whole new world. And I was like, bugs are awesome. Like, what have I been missing out on my whole life? I used to think that nature was something that I would only find in these vast landscapes in the Amazon rainforest or, you know, the savannas of Africa, lions, tigers, like polar bears. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh my gosh, like look at these little alien creatures that have been underfoot this whole time. And that really sparked this interest in wanting to share their stories with other people to help other people kind of have that same interest. And then, you know, the last decade or more, we've been learning about the decline of insects. So it's not just kind of creating that baseline appreciation, but also there's kind of a sense of urgency, right? Like we know biodiversity is in decline and there are so many ways that we can help and we can start in our own backyards and our own gardens.
Pretty cool. And the photos, particularly the ones you have of insects in the book are really, really cool. Did you, I'm assuming most of the photography or most of the photos in here are your own.
Yes, all but I think 10 or 12 photos of my are my own. My husband took a few of the aerial shots that you see of our landscape, yeah. But pretty much all the rest are my own, yep.
So you talk about homegrown conservation. How do you define homegrown conservation?
Yeah. I think there's a number of different ways that we can define it, but I think at its core, it's really taking a more stewardship approach to our landscape as opposed to a management approach. I think culturally and historically, we've taken this very heavy-handed management approach. We call it landscape management for a reason. It kind of implies that we're bending the land to our will, where we want to to do with the land what we as humans want, not what the natural inclination of the landscape is sort of destined to do. And as a result, we're pouring a lot of resources, particularly carbon-heavy resources, into that management. So homegrown conservation means taking a bit of a step back, taking a more stewardship approach, thinking of it as sort of like we're protectors, temporary protectors of this land for the time that we live here. And what we need to do is kind of realize all of the ecosystem connections that are happening or not happening as a result of how we could be managing the landscape. And we need to start restoring those ecosystem connections. We need to invite the wildlife back, put native plants back in our yards and in our community spaces. And that kind of creates the foundation for supporting wildlife.
And that probably inspired you to put this book together, I'm guessing.
It did. So I bought my first home about 15 years ago. And I remember thinking, you know, I want to do something, but I have no idea where to really get started. I think there's a lot of competing narratives out there too, especially in the landscape of social media. Things like, is no-mow May actually good? Or is it really bad? And should we not be participating in it? So there's just a lot of competing narratives. And I like to say I wrote the book that I wish I had 15 years ago when I bought my first home. And I just needed like a handy sort of Kickstarter guide to understand the wealth of actions that I could be taking. Yes, native plants are foundational, but that tends to be where the narrative begins and ends. Like, hey, put the native plants back and you're doing a great job. That's true, but there's so much more that we can do as well. And the book really goes into some of those deeper things like addressing light pollution or thinking about being more water friendly, or even there's a whole chapter on community science programs, ways to get involved and start to kind of create stock of what wildlife are visiting your landscape, whether it's pollinators or whether it's, you know, the bloom time of different flowers. Scientists are using that information to inform how the climate is changing and how it's impacting different species all over the world. And we can help contribute to that data sets from our own backyards.
And I think your hope is that a lot of the fight against climate change comes from all of us sitting in our own communities.
Individual power and individual action is so needed. And I think that this is another area where a lot of people feel very disempowered. We think, well, I'm just one person. What can I possibly do? We need the government to take action. We need corporations to take action. Again, yes, 100% true. We need big action because we know that's where a lot of the harm to the environment is coming from. But we have a lot of power in and of ourselves, whether it's our power of the dollar and what we buy and how much we buy, whether it's the power of our vote, you know, what legislators we're putting into office and what policies they are or are not enacting in support of the planet. But it's also the own actions that we take. A lot of people think, well, it's just my landscape. It's just my yard. It's just some grass. What's the harm? But we have 40 million acres of turf grass here in the U.S. It is the largest irrigated crop here in the country. And 40% of that is in our home landscapes. It's in my backyard, the front yard, you know, our suburbs and urban areas. And we can shift that. We can change that. And we can make a real difference for the planet.
Well, and one of the things you write about is letting go of turf grass.
Yeah. Yeah, letting go of grass is like step one, both from like an actionable standpoint, like we need to start moving our landscapes away from just being monocultures of weed-free, pest-free turf grass, but it's also a mind shift, right? Like we have to shift our way of thinking. We have to shift how we define beauty in these suburban landscapes. You know, having turf grass is a very cultural and societal thing. It represents this American dream. You have the big house, the big, highly manicured lawn. Again, very, very carbon intensive resource and water intensive resource to maintain. But there's beauty, I think, for a lot of that. And it's very much a societal thing. And it's reinforced by, you know, the train of landscapers that are parked along my street all day, every day, especially this time of year, as everybody's thinking about garden cleanup. It's reinforced by the train of door-to-door pest control salesmen that hover up on, now they use the hoverboards to get around the neighborhood. And they hover up and they're like, oh, we won't harm your pollinators, but we can get rid of everything else you don't want. And when I start probing and asking questions, like, well, tell me what you do, Target, by way of pest control. And they'll start to say things like, well, carpenter bees. And I'll tell them, you know, carpenter bees are actually really beneficial pollinators. So, you know, so much of it is just about kind of learning. It's about understanding what's at risk, beginning to appreciate that, and then kind of having that feeling empowered with the actionable items that we can all partake in to just do better.
Jeff, from the Birches and Bees Farm in Middlefield, Massachusetts, is listening in, a former Wisconsin resident, and he emailed to ask about pesticides or herbicides that you recommend for lawns, trees, and gardens. Are there nature-friendly products out there?
There's certainly a host of organic products that you can use, but actually I think the best approach is trying to foster a healthy balance in the ecosystem and in your landscape so that pest problems take care of themselves. You know, if you have aphids, for example, common garden pest, you know, rather than going out and immediately spraying pesticide or trying to treat it chemically, or even trying to like take a hose and spray them off, you can let it go for a few days and see if the lady beetles come and start taking care of the problem. I think too often we're very quick to want to take some sort of action and create a solution in the landscape without just taking a step back and recognizing that a healthy ecosystem has a healthy balance of predator-prey relationships. And that's ultimately what we're trying to do. Now, obviously, there's some pests that need to be controlled. Invasive species in particular sometimes need that. That may be chemical control or just a heavier lift, but it's really about learning and understanding and finding that balance.
You mentioned No Mow May earlier, which has got to be a kind of a big thing for many property owners. What do you think about that idea?
I have a lot of thoughts about No Mow May. I think it started in the UK as this initiative that basically said, you know, stop mowing your lawn in the month of May when the grass is really starting to grow. And a lot of our early emerging pollinators like bees are coming up from the landscape and they need floral resources to nectar and pollinate on. And unfortunately, in a lot of suburbs where we have these monocultures of turf grass, the bees don't find the floral resources that they need. The idea of No Mow May is if you let your lawn go, then you'll start to get some of those floral resources and it will provide a really healthy, is what a lot of people claim, you know, healthy resource of food. So this movement came to the U.S. a couple of years ago. It like just got blasted all over social media and it grew because it was like this super simple thing that you can do, right? Like what's better than or easier than just parking your mower for a month? Now we're starting to see the other side of that, some of the criticisms of the movement, things like, you know, most of what we're getting by way of floral resources are non-native dandelions and clover. Sometimes if you're lucky like me, you might have things like wild blue violet, which are often seen as a weedy species, but they are native and they're an important pollinator plant, especially this time of year. But there's some things to kind of break down, right? It's not as easy as like, oh, No Mow May is great or No Mow May is terrible. No Mow May can be a gateway for people who don't know where to start. And you don't have to go all in. You don't have to just stop mowing for an entire month. You can simply mow a little bit less frequently, or maybe just choose one patch of your landscape to not mow. That will help a host of different species. Things like fireflies, which kind of thrive in those taller grassy areas. Having a little bit of taller grass is great. But if you just park your mower for a month, your grass is probably going to go pretty high, especially if it rains a lot. Like here in Ohio, we've gotten tons of rain. And I'm not going to lie, we had to mow. My husband mowed this past weekend. And I know some people would be like, no, it's No Mow May. You shouldn't be mowing. Our grass, like our dandelions, were almost 2 feet tall, some of them. So you're going to upset your neighbors, potentially. You might end up with a city fine, maybe. So it has to be a balance. Ideally, too, you know, turf grass, even dandelions and clover, it's not the best food source for bees. We want the native plants that bees co-evolved alongside. Now, in a landscape that has nothing but dandelions and clover, those can sort of be like fast food in what's otherwise a food desert, So that's kind of how I like to contextualize it. Ideally, you're going to like rip out the turf grass and put in native plants. But if you're not there yet, then yeah, just mowing less frequently is a great start.
And mowing high. If you mow high, you should
mowing
be mowing.
Exactly. Anyway. Mow high. That's another really, really great and easy tip to implement.
Danae Wolf, our guest today, her book is titled Grass Isn't Greener, The Everyday Conservationist Guide to Bringing Nature to Your Yard. Questions or comments, or maybe you're doing something you want to add to the conversation along these lines, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Danae Wolf. Her new book is titled Grass Isn't Greener, The Everyday Conservationist Guide to Bringing Nature to Your Yard. And I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts and questions as we move along today. Number again, 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@WPR.org. Mary in Mountain, Wisconsin emailed, looking for some recommended trees for your yard that are great for wildlife, birds, and insects. Mary already has oaks, serviceberry, and black cherry in northern Oconee County with areas of full sun as well as shade, and she has sandy soil.
Yeah, so good question. Oaks are like the number one tree that you can plant for biodiversity. They support the highest diversity of Lepidopteran species, which are butterflies and moths. And you might be wondering, well, why do I want moths in my yard? Butterflies, of course, they're, you know, beautiful. Moths in particular, way more biodiverse than butterflies, by the way. And they provide a stellar food source for birds, particularly baby birds. So if you like birds, plant an oak tree. And sounds like you're doing the right thing with like the service berries and some of the other species that you recommended. It's a little bit tough to get really geographically specific and species specific here. So what I always recommend to people is plant for your ecoregion. The first chapter of the book is called Understand Your Land. And I cannot stress the importance of localizing the conversation, especially when you get to the question of, well, what do I plant? When you go to a big box retailer, for example, a big box nursery, you might find a ton of plants that are listed native. And they might be native here to the country. They might be native to the U.S., meaning they're not coming from another country, but they might not be native to your ecoregion. So we tend to use like the USDA plant hardiness zone map to dictate, you know, what to plant. That's going to help you understand like the survivability in terms of like cold hardiness, but it's not going to tell you which plants are going to support the highest biodiversity. So start by Googling what your ecoregion is, and then you can find incredible plant-specific, like ecoregion-specific plant guides from Pollinator Pathway, the Xerces Society, National Wildlife Federation, all fantastic resources that go through what flowers, what trees, what shrubs, what vines, what grasses are native to your region and will support biodiversity.
Christy in Chippewa County will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Christy.
Hi, thanks so much. I'm calling with a really strong testimony to what our speaker is presenting to us today. My yard is no mow. And it's quiet here with birds and fireflies, native plants. And my neighbors, I'm in an HOA wooded development where we can do what we wish. So I'm not watering, fertilizing, just loving this whole concept. The greatest challenge here, as with many areas, is the high density of whitetail. And so learning what deer will perhaps not browse as heavily, and then using quite a bit of fencing around native shrubs like nannyberry, dogwood, serviceberry, as well as some native trees. So excellent topic. And I like the realistic presentation of no mow May. I think there's a lot of validity there. Thank you. Learning so much today.
All right. Christy, thanks so much for calling. Comment, Danae?
I absolutely love to hear that. I love when people say like, yes, I'm doing this and look at the benefits that I'm seeing. And one thing mentioned there was the quiet I can go out into my yard and I hear quiet. I hear bird song. That is something that I will share from my own personal experience is not something that a lot of us are privileged in hearing. We go outside this time of year and what do we hear? A cacophony of leaf blowing and lawn mowing and work being done. And I get it. Like sometimes, you know, that's needed. But when it is a constant sound of just mowing and blowing and just whirring and buzzing, it's difficult. And it does drain out the bird song and just the natural sounds of nature. But yeah, sometimes I hear you. You mentioned, you know, being in an HOA, these are all things that we need to consider. I was very deliberate in including a whole chapter about forging community unity and like how to get along with your neighbors if they're not quite there yet in their understanding of the importance of this kind of work.
Doran emailed to ask, what do you do about anthills? There's a very large one that showed up in Doran's yard. And the question is, do they serve any good purpose?
So I have two huge anthills in my yard too. We have let them be. We don't do anything with them, despite, as I mentioned earlier, this train of door-to-door salesmen trying to sell us on pest control. We had one time and he was eyeing this anthill because he said, like, we can take care of the ants in your yard. And I was like, listen, the ants aren't causing us problem. They're food sources for, you know, a number of wildlife. But this idea of like, are they doing anything good? This is a perception that I'm trying to change because in the world of insects, we often ask that question. You know, I can go and give the most incredible story of, I'll talk about oak tree hoppers in particular, which are my favorite insect. They display maternal care. I've photographed like this maternal observation and care of an insect, which is kind of unusual in the world of bugs. And I can share this photo story with people. And immediately following, they ask, well, what good are oak tree hoppers to people? And it's kind of shifting that narrative of, do they have to be good for us to appreciate them and their place in the environment? They have intrinsic value. They play a role in the ecosystem. Lots of different ant species disperse seeds and help with planting, you know, different plant seeds. And ants just have fascinating sort of colonies, and the way that they've developed is not all that dissimilar from sort of human structures. And it's just fascinating. So what I would invite listeners to think about is what intrinsic value does any species have? Even things that we tend to really not like ticks or like mosquitoes, they all play a role in the ecosystem, whether we like it or not. And, you know, if they're causing problems, if all of a sudden you have an anthill that, you know, kind of erupted near your foundation and now you're having ants come into your home, or you have a wasp nest, you know, in a very highly trafficked area of your home, like in the eaves above your front door, those are situations where you might need to ask yourself, okay, what do I need to do to manage this for my own safety? But oftentimes we can just let things be.
Well, I think you mentioned ticks. I think Wisconsin is the tick capital of the world. And I thought it was kind of fun. You had something about creating your own tick tubes
if ticks are an issue. And this is when we talk about wildlife gardening, a lot of people start to question, like, are we going to invite ticks into our landscape, especially if we're leaving the leaves? You know, we talk about in the autumn, leave your leaves where they are or let your grass grow a little bit taller. And a lot of people think like these are prime habitats for ticks. And actually the research shows that prime habitat for ticks is these sort of margin areas between like a manicured like lawn, like turf grass, we head into like forest. So it's where we have like shrubbier, sort of weedy growth. So there are some ways that you can, you know, make sure that you're not creating that prime tick habitat. And one of those is through these sort of homemade tick tubes. You can buy them commercially too, but you can, you know, with some pesticides applied to, it could be cotton balls, you know, like organic, you know, safe cotton balls that you can have out in the landscape. You basically apply like a pyrethroid to it. And the idea is that mice that tend to be vectors of ticks in the landscape, they'll come and they'll use that cotton. You can even use like dryer lint as long as it wasn't treated with like heavy chemicals or detergents. You can take that dryer lint, soak that in the pesticide, put it in this little like toilet paper or paper towel, like cardboard tube. and then place it on sort of the outskirts of your yard, the mice will come by and take those like little pieces of cotton back to their nest and basically help to kill the ticks from kind of their starting point before they can ever come out into your landscape. But there are other things that we can manage for too. We can create, you know, more solid barriers. So rather than having these like weedy overgrown barriers between maybe a manicured garden and more of like a forest habitat, you know, create a barrier of a couple feet of either mulch or gravel, and that will help detract and reduce that prime tick habitat in your landscape.
I'm thinking of the, I can't remember how many ticks per mile we have here in the state of Wisconsin, but it is indeed a large number. One of the things that I found interesting, and this goes back to soil, you have a couple of pages on what's your type, soil type, where you describe the various types, but then also give a way that you can figure it out with basically a mason jar and some water and a little ruler. I had never seen that before.
And it's such an easy thing to do. Soil type is so important to the health of your plants. You know, we talk about putting native plants in our landscapes all day long, but what we don't often talk about is in many of our urban and suburban landscapes, the soil ecosystem has been heavily degraded. It's been modified, it's been tilled, it's been heavily compacted because we're walking on it or, you know, mowing over it with heavy lawn mowers all the time. So this like really regenerating soil health is, I mean, quite literally foundational to the health of the plants, which then will support wildlife. So there's a very, very easy soil. It's a soil type test that you can do. So it's not going to test for things like nutrient availability in your soil, but it will help you identify, you know, do you have a sandier soil? Do you have a more clay soil, which is might be a little bit harder to grow certain types of plants? You basically collect a soil sample, put it in a mason jar, fill it most of the way with water, shake it up very vigorously, and then let it sit for a couple of days. And those soil layers will start to settle out. And then you can literally just use a ruler, apply some basic calculations, and you can start to get sort of this percentage of what types of soil you have. And then that can inform, okay, if you have really sandy soil, you're not going to be holding on to water very readily. So the water is going to drain much more easily, which might impact what plants you choose. If you have very like clay soil, might be waterlogged, you know, it's going to be a wetter area. So you're going to grow plants that have those water loving roots.
I thought it was a pretty cool way to do it. I thought I might even try it just for fun in my own yard. Although I think I'm pretty well up on what the soil is. You do talk about testing the soil.
Yeah, I'm doing a soil test, and you can get a soil testing kit maybe from your local soil and water conservation district, your extension office. You can buy them again commercially, either online or locally. But understanding the availability of nutrients is really key here too. Not only your soil type, but are there some like modifications that you need to be making? Are there some, you know, amendments that you need to be making? And this will either inform or potentially even reduce like the amount of fertilization that you have to do. The less chemicals that we can put into the landscape, the better. We tend to be very fertilizer heavy, right? We think, oh, we need to even our lawns, we fertilize. And then it rains and those fertilizers run off into local waterways. And, you know, here in Ohio, just north of me is Lake Erie. And we get these horrible, harmful algal blooms every summer because of the excess nutrients like fertilizers that are running off into our waterways and ultimately Lake Erie. These harmful algal blooms are creating like dead zones, ecological dead zones in the waterways. They're making it really unsafe for people to recreate in the lake as well. So anything that we can do to inform how we can reduce those chemical inputs is going to be fantastic. So start with a soil test to determine what your soil landscape looks like and what you need to do to make it healthy.
Yeah. I was thinking about Wisconsin here. Most of our soils are very phosphorus rich, and so many areas have kind of laws against fertilizers for lawns, for example, that do not. You want them without phosphorus.
Yeah, makes sense.
Because phosphorus is the element that really creates those blooms that
exactly
that you were talking about. Insects, let's, you know, you're really up on insects. And you certainly, as a gardener, a lot of times you think about only the pests, the insects that are kind of pests. And you did talk a little bit about how other insects can take care of the problems, like scale, for example. But the pest control methods you prefer are basically that, correct?
The pest control methods that I always prefer, yes, are creating basically that balance in the ecosystem where you have predators readily at hand. And when I say predators, we're talking about things like, you know, native praying mantids, we're talking about lacewings, we're talking about lady beetles, which I mentioned earlier. Ambush bugs are one of my absolute favorite insects, although admittedly, I think I say that about every insect. But there's assassin bugs and ambush bugs. And I mean, crab spiders, jumping spiders, there's a host of different critters out there that feed on other insects all day long, right? That's just what they do, whether they're feeding on leaf hoppers, plant hoppers, you mentioned scale, little white flies, aphids, like there's stuff happening out there all the time. The diversity of parasitoid wasps in particular, this is something that I think is so under-researched and under-talked about in the world of gardening. I have heard that entomologists suggest that there could be a parasitoid for just about every species of insect out there. And we're talking about a million described species of insects, right? So there's probably a parasitoid that basically lays its eggs in or on a species of insect, and their young hatch, and then they feed on that insect and they take care of it, right? So there's so much value in creating that harmony and that balance before we immediately go out with a chemical control. Now, there are things that we can and should be doing, though, you know, just to kind of reduce that pest pressure. Again, it goes back to planting the right plants in the right place, making sure that, you know, it's not soil log. Plants that are not healthy are going to be at increased risk. They're going to be more vulnerable to predation by those plant-eating bugs. So healthy plants are going to just do better anyway. And most plants have evolved to withstand a certain threshold of feeding from whether it's caterpillars or anything else. So again, healthy plants need healthy soil, and then that will create this like balance of relationships in the landscape.
I was thinking about scale, because when you bring a plant into the house and it's got scale, there's nothing there to get, you know, to feed on it. I don't notice much scale outside in my landscape.
Yeah, I see it occasionally, but I also don't like, I'm not out looking for it, but we have a lot of aphid pressure here, even on those native plants like milkweed. You know, I have a lot of questions from people like, oh, we planted milkweed for the monarchs, but they're covered in aphids or other things, other native species. And a lot of people ask, well, how do we get rid of all of those things on these native plants that we planted for monarchs? This would be a good time to kind of remind folks that if you're planting something like milkweed for monarchs, milkweeds support a host of different insects too. So you might see milkweed beetles, milkweed bugs, and think, oh no, I don't want those on my milkweed because those aren't monarchs. Research actually shows that milkweed plants that have a higher diversity of arthropod species of things like the milkweed bugs and milkweed beetles actually increase the survivability of monarch caterpillars. And the idea there, the thought anyway, is that it's because you're kind of creating a buffet of options for a predator like a bird to come feed on. If it was just a monarch caterpillar, then the bird would eat the caterpillar. But now that the bird has a couple different options, it's going to increase that survivability and that chance of that caterpillar eventually making its way to a butterfly.
You're big on eliminating one thing, and that's invasives. Invasive plants. Talk about that. Some ornamental plants can become, have become invasive.
Yeah. In fact, many of our invasive plants were brought here as ornamentals. That said, not all ornamentals are bad. I think this conversation around wildlife gardening, sometimes people think it has to be all or nothing. It has to be all native or nothing at all. You can have a balance of non-native plants alongside native plants so long as they're not invasive. And many of the plants that we have in our landscapes are just that. They've turned invasive. We're talking, you know, a number of non-native honeysuckle species. We're talking things like privet and barberry. Bradford pear. I don't know how big Bradford pear is in Wisconsin. Here in Ohio,
you got a cool story. You got a cool story about, tell that story.
So Bradford pear, you know, this beautiful, although rather smelly, especially this time of year, ornamental plant that was basically bred to be a sterile variety of pear. And because of that, we planted them everywhere, like decades ago. We planted them as street trees all over the place, started to recognize that the branching structure of this particular species was kind of weak. And the branches would typically break off in ice storms or like wind storms, which obviously causes a risk if they're growing over sidewalks in suburban communities. So we started to breed some other varieties of pears that we could place in the landscape. We did that. And long story short, they co-bred with this other variety and created like this monster species that can now reproduce. It produces viable seed. And now we have this Bradford pear literally everywhere. It's in bloom this time of year. And it's interesting because if you don't know what you're looking at, it looks really beautiful. I mean, we're talking like acres along the sides of highways here in Ohio that you'll just see this like, you know, white blooming tree, and it looks pretty. And then when you tell people like, no, that's Bradford pear, it's a horrible plant, it's a stinky plant, and we don't want them, it starts to kind of reshape your perception a little bit. So plant identification, if you've just moved into a new home or you haven't been gardening for wildlife, going out and beginning to kind of identify what species you have growing, you might be surprised that some of your the plants that seem to not be invasive, because you might not see them popping up in your own landscape, you might be surprised to learn that they're very invasive. And what happens is, and this is sort of the key characteristic of what makes a plant truly invasive, is its ability to jump borders. So you might not be seeing that plant grow very aggressively in your cultivated landscape, but it's probably because you're mowing, you're manicuring your landscape. Birds could be coming by and eating the fruits and seeds of those plants and then dropping them in nearby forests or fields where they grow, and then they just take off and they begin to basically destroy and completely alter these native natural landscapes, like our favorite parks.
Jeff in Middlefield, Massachusetts, we go to you now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there. Thanks for this great segment of your show. Ms. Wolf, like I have a farm, and you know, I can't wait to buy your book. Obviously, your advice and guidance isn't just for like suburbs and cities. It also applies to rural people, because you know, I bought a horse farm, and I'm trying to get rid of most of the grass we don't cut. I only use leopard frogs and garter snakes for fighting the insects. But I have two major problems. Anyone that's grown potatoes that's listening knows that if you don't put any chemicals on, which we don't, I have to pick off those potato beetles three times a day in order to keep the plant surviving. That's the first one. And the second one is knotweed. It's like a zombie. You cannot get rid of it. Japanese knotweed. Do you have any advice or recommendations on either or both of those? Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great question. So potato beetles, I'm not a farmer myself, but I think that you're absolutely right that so many of the concepts in this book apply to all sorts of landscapes. We talk a lot about like the home, you know, the backyard, the suburb, the urban areas, but they really apply everywhere. We're talking about some more like philosophical approaches to our landscapes. I can't talk about the potato beetles in particular again, because I'm not a potato farmer. But what I will say is I think that agriculture has been blamed so much for the heavy use of pesticides. And we're like, oh, it's all the farms and it's not what I'm applying to my roses in my own backyard. We apply more pesticides per hectare or per acre to our home ornamental landscapes than farmers are applying to their farms. And farms are giving us food, you know, to feed a growing global population of people. Our yards are not doing that. They're, you know, they're providing something to look at. The ornamental plants that we're often treating are like pretty botanical statues in the landscape. So I would say, you know, we really need to reduce the pesticides use in our home landscapes, but farms are a completely different story. As far as the knotweed goes, we have knotweed here in Ohio as well. I used to work for the National Park Service. I was a park ranger, and we would actually host what we called knotweed stomps, where we would invite the public to come and literally like stomp it down, which was quite fun, actually. And then they would come in with chemical treatment and spray it. So this is another area when we're talking about invasive plants that tend to, like, yeah, you can treat them manually. You can, you know, cut the stems of like honeysuckle, for example. Typically, you're going to have to come in and do like a spot treatment of like a glyphosate to soak down into those roots and to start to kill the plant. And probably not just one time, right? These plants are invasive because characteristically, they are very, very aggressive growers. So it's about treating the plants, but doing so in a way that you're doing it at the right time of day, not when it's going to drift all over the place onto non-target plants and other organisms. It's doing it the right time of year so that you're reducing harm to the environment and non-target species. And then it's doing so, again, not just like mass spraying, but it might be more targeted, a targeted application approach.
Jeff, thank you very much for calling. Talking today with Danae Wolf, who has written the book Grass Isn't Greener, and you can join in too at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here as we talk with Danae Wolf. And by the way, Danae's first name is spelled D-A-N-A-E, which I think is pretty cool. And Wolf, like the animal with an E on the end of it.
Appreciate that.
And the title of the book, Grass Isn't Greener, The Everyday Conservationist Guide to Bringing Nature to Your Yard. John in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. John, hi.
Hi, Larry and Danae. Been really enjoying the program today. Something that I've kind of been thinking about just as you talk, and I wanted to ask kind of your thoughts on. I live here in Madison. There's a relatively big push for like spreading wildflower seeds kind of randomly through the area. I mean, I bicycle a lot. I see a lot of people just with like a shaker on the front of their bike with native wildflower seeds. And I've always kind of wondered, you know, if you're shaking some seeds onto a spot on the ground, you know, how effective is this? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah. I do have some thoughts on that. And I've actually seen this. This has been like a big trend on TikTok where people basically take like a pepper shaker, like one with like nice big holes that you can get, you know, flower seeds through. And what do they call it? It's like flower bombing, or you're just like literally.
Guerrilla gardening.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly it. And I see people on skateboards or bikes and they just go along and shake things. A lot of those people have confirmed that they are using, you know, regionally local and native species, which I think obviously is a great start. I like to think of things as like a spectrum of good, better, and best. We want to put flowers back in the landscape, and anywhere that there's not flowers where there could be, like, fantastic. Let's get the floral resources back into the landscape to help particularly the pollinators. But if it's an area of land that you don't own, you don't steward, you don't manage, you don't know what's going to happen with it over time, you know, sometimes it takes more than just shaking some seeds on the ground to actually establish plants. Sometimes they do need to be watered. You know, there's this idea that if you plant native, you don't need to do anything. You just plant it and, you know, the plant will take care of itself. Oftentimes plants still need to be established and, you know, watered. They need to be planted in the right place. So if you're planting, you know, sun-loving plants in an area that is predominantly shady, they're not going to grow. But also this idea of like land ownership. Are you planting stuff on a plot of land, you know, where somebody doesn't want to plant something? So, well, I think it's great to like put plants back, and I think it's fun. I guess I have mixed thoughts about like the land ownership aspect of things, but the more we can do to put those flowers back into the landscape, the better.
John, thanks for calling. Robert in Amherst Junction, your turn. Hi, Robert.
Hi. I'm sorry to correct your guest on the air, but I think it's important that we are very careful about the kind of pesticides that we put into the environment. What she said about the tick tubes is a little bit wrong. I've been using them for years. They work great, but we don't want to put a whole bunch of pyrethroids in the environment because they harm a lot of other beneficial insects. The correct substance is called permethrin.
Permethrin. You're right. You're exactly right. I really appreciate that correction.
Yeah. Robert, thanks for that correction. Yeah, he is exactly right.
Yep. It is permethrin. Yep.
Thank you, Robert. Appreciate that call. Well, boy, we're starting to run out of time, and there's so many things that we haven't. There are many chapters that we haven't dealt with here. One of the things about leaves, you mentioned leaving your leaves where they fall.
Yes, and this is a hard one for people because I think we've grown so accustomed to, oh, it's autumn, let's go out with a leaf blower and start blowing the leaves up and taking them away from the landscape. It's very hard, I think, for people to just let their leaves stay where they fall because we have these neighborhood expectations, right? We want the turf grass. We don't want to suffocate the grass with the leaf layer. So that's important. But there are things that you can do. In my landscape, what we've done is actually create these like bordered, using landscape stones, borders under the canopy of the two great big pin oak trees in our front yard. And we will rake our leaves into those dedicated beds. And we're managing them like sort of the understory of a forest. So we're planting things like ferns, spice bush, and witch hazel. And we're really trying to steward them like a forest habitat. So there are ways that you can still keep the leaves in your landscape for the benefit of wildlife without having to, you know, go all in and just let them suffocate your grass and decompose very slowly over time.
Yeah, well, in a forest situation or a wooded situation, those leaves turn into fertilizer. I mean, it's just a circle of life kind of thing in a forest kind of setting. The other area I did want to bring up before we run out of time is lighting. You talk about lighting and you talk about power tools, and I'm kind of big on the lighting side of things too. So talk about your comments in your book.
Yeah, I have a whole chapter on the impacts of light pollution in the landscape, which is becoming a more well-researched topic in terms of how we can support or impact negatively wildlife. And light pollution, especially this time of year with like migratory birds coming back from their overwintering grounds in the south, they're coming back to their northern breeding grounds now, this time of year. Light pollution will draw birds into suburban and urban landscapes where they're at increased risk of bird strikes. That means flying into windows or typically because they see the reflection of what they think is sky or trees. And that creates mortality. Window strikes are one of the leading causes. Cats are also one of the leading causes, outdoor cats in particular, of bird mortality. But there are simple things that we can do, like shutting off any outdoor unnecessary lights overnight. If you have lights that need to stay on for safety, security, putting them on a motion sensor. If you have lights that just sort of blast, you know, light up into the atmosphere, creating that extra glare, that extra glow in the environment. If you can shade those, that's great. If you do have other lights that need to stay on, swapping bulbs to more of an amber color can actually reduce the way that they attract like insects. They'll just less attractive to insects, which means you're drawing fewer birds in that are coming for those insects. So that's key. And Larry, too, you mentioned just this idea of like powering down and power tools, too. Going back to this idea of like carbon emissions, the way that we landscape traditionally tends to create this increased use of electricity. Even if you've switched over to electric tools as opposed to gas powered, they're still usually driven by a carbon based energy grid. And as a result, they're still creating these like indirect emissions. So anything that we can do to just reduce that power, not everybody's in a position to do that due to maybe mobility. It's not always easy to swap a leaf blower for a rake. So we need to be mindful of considerations like that, but there's so much that we can do, even planting the right plants to kind of create windbreaks and, you know, shade our homes during the summer and create those windbreaks, which help with, just keeping our house more insulated during the colder months. These are all things that we can do to benefit the planet.
And all included in your book and a whole lot more. Danae, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much for taking time. And your book's only been out a day or two. Well, I hope it does well. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Danae Wolf, her book, Grass Isn't Greener, the subtitle, The Everyday Conservationist Guide to Bringing Nature to Your Yard. Coming up, we're going to turn our attention to the sky and the stars and exoplanets. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Some space-age type music to get you thinking about space and the skies and the talk of things like exoplanets. You know, we got these super-powered telescopes, and the discovery of exoplanets is picking up speed, I think we could say. And we have with us a couple of astronomers talk about exoplanets and what else is going on in the dark, in the night sky. Our exoplanet researcher is Thomas Beatty, an assistant professor in the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy. Thomas, welcome to the show.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, great to have you here. Also with us, a long time, I don't know how many times you've been on the show, Jim Lattice.
Got me.
100 times?
Probably not 100, but
director,
maybe it just seems like it.
Director of the UW-Madison Space Place, UW Space Place, for at least another little bit of time.
A little short time, yeah.
Little short time. He's retiring soon. So sorry about that, but maybe you'll still come back and be with us from time to time.
Oh, sure. You bet. I'm always happy to talk about this kind of stuff. So thanks for the invitation today.
He is, of course, faculty associate in astronomy at the UW-Madison College of Letters and Sciences. And we're going to talk about exoplanets, but we'll talk about other things as well in the night sky as we move along today. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or maybe your own experiences. What have you seen that's intriguing or interesting? What do you want to know about exoplanets? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Boy, we've been hearing and seeing a lot in television and in social media and newspapers about exoplanets. And Thomas, I'll maybe turn to you for to start with. What is an exoplanet, and how do you find them?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, an exoplanet is just the same way, you know, that we have planets that go around the sun that make up the solar system. So the solar system are all the planets that go around our sun that we can see up in the sky. And an exoplanet is, this is the exact same thing. It's just planets that orbit other stars. So all the stars you see up in the night sky, a bunch of them actually have planets orbiting them. And the first one that we found was 30 years ago, 1995. And now we're up to almost 6,000 planets that we know of that orbit other stars.
And how do we, we're using some pretty powerful telescopes, I'm assuming, here for this.
Yeah, and the trick is with them is that, you know, the first thing is all of them are very nearby on a galactic or universal scale. All of them are inside the Milky Way, but they're all, for everyday usage, they're all super far away. They're at least a couple hundred light years, but they're all close to us on the scale of the Milky Way.
And a light year...
Yeah, light year. It's how far light travels in a year. I don't know, Jim. Do you know how many miles that is?
It's like 6 trillion miles, if that means anything. But it's, you know, the nearest star to the sun is the Alpha Centauri system, where there are exoplanets, and that's 4-ish light years away. So even the nearest star is a few light years.
So if you're going to jump in the car and drive a light year, you're going around around the world and around the world and around the world.
Yeah, those kind of numbers get. Yeah, just start thinking about how long it takes light. Light takes 8 minutes to get from the sun to us on the Earth. So the distance from the Earth to the sun is 8 light minutes. So not, you know, so maybe that helps put the light year in perspective. How much farther will that light go the rest of the year after the first 8 minutes? It's going to be out there, but it's not even going to reach the our nearest stellar neighbors.
Wow. Well, Thomas, you know, you've discovered, you yourself have discovered exoplanets, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. Yep. I've discovered probably about 2 dozen of them. Unfortunately, I haven't gotten to name any of them myself.
Darn.
I know. They all get
Why
these
don't
catalogs.
You get to name them yourself?
It's an excellent question, Larry. I lobbied really hard with my PhD advisor. And unfortunately, they all get these catalog names that, as we say, only a sentimental astronomer would love.
So the names are like X4 or 5 PW or something?
Yeah. If you work in it, you sort of get to know it, because a lot of them are named after the surveys. So there will be like the ones we found were like KELT 1 through 20, Kepler something. But a bunch of them have catalog numbers that are HD209458. Is actually a
Pretty
very
memorable.
Famous one, but
why is that famous?
It was the first one that I actually found that transited, so it went in front of its star. So for exoplanet people, HD209458 is a number you can just reel off the top of your head. Like I said, only sentimental astronomers actually know these things.
Well, why in the heck do we study them?
That's a good question. I mean, to start off with, I think, you know, in the mid-90s, before, you know, any exoplanets had really been discovered, there was just the basic question of, are there other planets around other stars? We didn't know that for sure. And so when we thought about the question of how do planets form, there was a lot of debate about whether or not the planets in our solar system were the result of a very rare event and were sort of a one-off, or if planets seem to happen all the time. And we now know that planets seem to happen pretty much all the time. We think that every star, on average, has at least one planet around it. So we know a lot more about planet formation. And secondly, we're really actively trying to pursue detecting life on other planets outside the solar system as well. So it helps us understand where planets come from, and then hopefully try and find life elsewhere in the universe.
Yeah. And Jim, there was a research paper published earlier in the last year, I think actually the last month or so, revealing the discovery of 2 exoplanets larger than Earth. Are you familiar with these? And orbiting a sun-like star.
Well, yeah, so that it's easier, correct me if I'm wrong, it's easier to find more massive planets.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of selection effects that go into the search. So there are some that are easier to find than others, and lower mass ones are harder to find than higher mass ones. I don't know about those particular two, but I do remember that about a year ago, a UW team discovered an Earth mass exoplanet.
Yeah, that's one I was thinking.
And that's kind of cool to find a thing. I think it was a Earth mass, or pretty close enough, I guess, to Earth mass. And that was I actually just happened to have that. I used this as an example last night. That was around the star HD63433. So
I know that one.
Yeah,
well.
Yeah, really, I'm sure. You'll want to jot that one down, yeah. But that was a team that included at least 3 UW astronomers that detected that planet. And the thing is that that's not all that uncommon. These are, as Thomas said, they're coming along. We're up in the thousands now, and they keep ticking them off as they get better and better at finding these things.
Well, at those distances, we can't see them with our naked eyes, any of them?
No, so only very rarely. We only have direct images of maybe about a dozen planets, but they're all super large planets, bigger than Jupiter, and they're all pretty far away from their stars. The analogy I use when I talk about this sometimes is that trying to see the Earth next to the Sun at the distances that we're sort of thinking about is like you're standing in New York City and you're trying to take a picture of a firefly that's about 5 feet away from a searchlight, and the two of them are in Los Angeles. And that's the sort of problem. And actually, I worked out the math on that once, and it's actually not quite right, because actually that problem's probably about 100 times easier than...
No, wait. So the telescope is in New York City.
Yeah.
And the Firefly and the Searchlight are in Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles.
And the Firefly is a 5 feet away or a few feet away from the Searchlight. So you're trying to pick out the Firefly from the light of the Searchlight.
Right, next to the Searchlight.
Okay.
Right. So it's very hard. Yeah.
And that's easier than finding exoplanets.
Yeah. And that's 100 times easier. That's right. So it's simple, Jim. It's simple.
Oh, my gosh.
But, yeah, so all the ways we do it is we have to be clever. We have to be indirect. So generally we never see the planet itself. We see what it does to its star. So we see the star moving back and forth. We can measure that. Or we see the planet passing in front of the star and making it appear dimmer from our perspective on the Earth.
So there's a little bit of, I mean, is this, okay, I think I saw a shade there. Is that, so I found an exoplanet or?
A little bit. There's, I mean, what I did for my PhD was run what we call a transit survey, where we just took pictures of the night sky for 4 years straight. And at the end of that, we could look at 1,000 stars and watch to see if anything had gone in front of them.
So you see a little flick, a very little decrease in the light from the star. It's like an eclipse.
Yeah.
Except it's, we see the moon eclipse the sun and the sun disappears almost completely. But in this case, it's that Firefly that's blocking some of the light of the Searchlight, and that little dip in the light is.
Yeah, that's a very good analogy.
Yeah, okay. Analogy. Yeah.
Nope, it's a very good analogy. Yeah, and it's a very defined shape, so you know what the shape should be. But even then, we would get 100 possibilities. We'd get 100 candidates and then run them down.
In 4 years of...
Right, well, we got more than that, but we would get 100 candidates that we'd have to look through before we got one real planet. So it was very emotionally trying the first when we started, because I remember there were some weekends where I thought we had a real good one and we'd wait for some more detailed observations to come in. And then on Monday we'd get the email and it turns out it didn't happen. And it was a real emotional roller coaster for a year or two trying to find these things.
And you've got them classified. They're classified as, I thought these are really cool ways to classify things. You've got super Earth and sub-Neptune exoplanets.
Yeah, they're it's funny names. It's sort of weird. It's watching the field. The names have sort of evolved. We always try and relate it to things in the solar system. So there's a super Earth, a sub-Neptune, a hot Jupiter. They're all related to the planets in the solar system. And people try and figure out these names. For a while, hot Jupiters, which are these giant planets that are thousands of degrees. People tried to call them roasters. That didn't really catch. I once had a debate at a scientific conference where me and somebody else got up and I argued for sub-Neptunes and they were arguing for Neptunes, which...
I'm glad you won that one.
Yeah. Well, it did have a certain panache, I guess. Somebody wanted hot Neptunes to be hop tunes. That didn't really catch on.
Gee.
But, you know, we give these names to them, but it's important to remember that those are just based on really just how big they are. Like a super Earth means just a planet that's larger than the Earth. That's all that means. And a sub-Neptune is something that's smaller than Neptune. It doesn't really tell us anything about what these planets are like, which is now what we're really trying to figure out.
Yeah. Talking with Jim Lattice, director of the UW Space Place, and Thomas Bede. Thomas is an assistant professor in the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy, and he does a lot of research on exoplanets. And I hope you'll join in. Maybe you have a question about exoplanets. Maybe you have a question about the night sky. I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the night sky and looking at exoplanets, we've been zeroing in on the exoplanets a bit with our two guests, Jim Lattice of the UW Space Place, Thomas Bede, assistant professor in the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy, conducts observational studies of exoplanets. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234 or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Are you able to, here's an email, are you able to tell which elements or materials make up exoplanets? And if so, how in the heck do you do it?
A subject near and dear to my heart. That's actually what most of my research is on, is once we find them, how do we actually figure out what they're made out of? So that's a super good question. It's what we've spent the last like 20 years trying to figure out how to do well. The basic idea is that if you get one of these planets, as we were talking about, that goes in front of its star,
mm-hmm.
As it goes in front of the star, if you could imagine that in your mind, the planet, like the moon passing in front of the star, there's this little fuzz of atmosphere right around the edges of that planet. And the starlight, as it goes past the planet, that fuzz of atmosphere imprints on the starlight a little bit. And so we can actually measure the atmosphere that way. And it's a very subtle measurement. For something like the Earth, our atmosphere, it's almost the same thickness as the apple skin on top of an apple. So we can't quite do that yet, but we're actually getting pretty close. Mostly we do larger planets like Neptune or Jupiter-sized.
Because they have larger, denser atmospheres, more extended atmospheres.
Yeah. That's right, because they have larger atmospheres. But yeah, we're doing it. The last 3 years since the launch of the James Webb Space Telescope has really cracked this whole field open. So we've seen water, carbon dioxide, methane, ammonia, hydrogen sulfide, all sorts of hydrogen and carbon and oxygen and sulfur species, which are sort of what we expected, but it's very exciting because it tells us a lot about how the planet's formed. You know, it's like if you're trying to bake a cake, we can't actually watch the cake baking itself, but we can look at the cake after it's made, pull it apart, see what the ingredient list had to be, and figure out what the baking recipe had to be. That's sort of what we're doing with planets. We're looking at what they're made out of now and trying to figure out how they must have formed to have that composition we see.
Still trying to, still not quite figuring out in my own head, or maybe I just missed it. When you're looking at that atmosphere, then how do you know that here's an element of this or here's something of that?
Oh, that's a very good point. Yes. So when we look at it, we don't just look at, one way to look at it would be to take pictures, like what I did as a PhD student, to just find mm-hmm. planets. Is we just took pictures and we looked for, as Jim said, that firefly going in front of the star. What we do is something like with the Webb Space Telescope is we take that light and we split it up into a spectrum. So we spread it out for wavelength and we sort of split all the colors up. And different molecules absorb different amount of lights at different colors. So the atmosphere, that thin fuzz of atmosphere, will look thicker where there's a lot of, say, water at those wavelengths. And so we'll see a thicker atmosphere there, and then it'll thin out where there's nothing really absorbing. And then for carbon dioxide, it'll get thicker again. So that's what we're looking for, how thick the atmosphere is at different wavelengths or different colors. And that lets us identify molecules.
A number of emails here. Why don't we see a bunch of questions related to kind of the night sky? Why don't we see much of the Milky Way in the springtime evening in the night sky?
Well, I'll take that one. So it's back when, January or so, if you went out, right after dark, you'd see the Milky Way stretching right overhead. Here in Wisconsin, it would be just high overhead. And a year later, it would be back. 6 months later, we'd be seeing the summer Milky Way stretching overhead. But if you go about a quarter of a year, then the Milky Way ends up being on the horizon for us, at our latitude, or roughly our latitude. And that's what's happening now at sunset. The Milky Way is more or less around the horizon. So it's there, of course, but even when it's overhead, it's diffuse. That's why it's milky, right? It's not very prominent. So if it's around the horizon, you're looking through so much atmosphere, you don't really see the Milky Way at all. So all you have to do is wait a few hours. At this time of year, if you wait till midnight, 1 a.m., the summer Milky Way will be high in the eastern sky, even at a certain point during the night, directly overhead. And the only reason we call it the summer Milky Way is it's still springtime, but it'll be there right after sunset, right after dark, when we're in high summer, July, August.
Yeah.
It'll get dark and you'll see the Milky Way stretching high overhead. So yeah, so springtime and autumn are times when the Milky Way is the plane of the galaxy that we live in, right? So we're stretching, the stars are not in a ball or anything, spread out into sort of a large disk. And so we're looking out of the plane of the galaxy. We're looking, and that's why astronomers that study galaxies and things like that, that's where you're looking into truly deep space. You're looking past our galaxy. Along the Milky Way, our lines of sight are typically kind of limited, at least in the optical. We don't see very far. But looking out, look up towards Ursa Major and Leo, for example. Those are constellations that are high overhead these days. There are major clusters and superclusters of galaxies out there because we can see so far out into space that way. So it's really, we don't see any of that. Even with amateur telescopes, it's a bit of a struggle to see like a galaxy cluster or something like that. You can see them if you got a good telescope and know where to point it. But that's why the sky is relatively dark and free of all the stuff that we find in the Milky Way, because we're looking so far out of the plane of our galaxy and so far into deep space.
Interesting. Just to go along with that, another email. What if anything can we see at night with a pair of good binoculars rather than a telescope?
Yeah. So actually, this is, and that, it's a good time of year to be doing that. I can suggest a couple of things. The easiest thing right now, there's a very very nice star cluster. It's very famous among amateur astronomers. It's called the Beehive Cluster. So stars often come in clusters. Our sun is not a member of a cluster. Probably was once upon a time, and the gravitational forces in the galaxy often pull these clusters apart, but they form in clusters. And so there's a very nice cluster in the springtime sky called the Beehive Cluster, which is easy enough to find, but it's even easier right now because the planet Mars is just a little bit to the east of the Beehive Cluster. So you can go out at about, let's just say 9 p.m. as it's starting to get nice and dark. And you have to navigate your way over to Mars, which is not hard to find.
No.
It's prominent enough. It's not super bright like Jupiter is over there in the west. But find Mars with your binoculars and then scan a little bit to it, depending on what time you are, a little bit to the right. Just scan the area in the sky to the right of Mars, and you'll see it. There'll be a very nice concentration of stars, and that's the Beehive Cluster. So, it's easy enough to find even without Mars, but Mars is up there kind of leading us right that way as it happens this time of year. So that's nice. If you get out a little bit earlier and you look at Jupiter with your binoculars, you'll see the moons of Jupiter, the Galilean moons. You don't really need a telescope. You won't see any detail on Jupiter, but you'll see the moons that are orbiting around Jupiter there with your binoculars. They're easily powerful enough to, most binoculars are easily powerful enough to do that. You can even see a few binary stars if you look up, for example, up at the middle star in the handle of the Big Dipper, which is called Mizar. It's got a companion called Alcor, but they aren't really connected. But Mizar itself is a binary star system. Actually, I think there's like six of them up there. But you can see the two widest space ones in most binoculars. You'll see that it's really two stars side by side there. So there's a binoculars will take you a long way. A little bit of time spent with a star chart and a pair of binoculars. So I also recommend a lawn chair, yeah. makes it a little easier on your neck when you're trying to scan the sky with your binoculars. But
or
they're great
tools. Or one of those apps.
Right, there's lots of apps that will lead you around. Yeah, that's right. They're a good way to do it.
Thomas, do you ever sit there with a pair of binoculars? Well, most of the time, probably not.
Larry, I actually have two young kids, so most of the time when it's dark, I am fast asleep because I'm up at 5:30 a.m. every morning.
Yeah, especially with two kids. Oh my gosh. Well, here's a question another email. What is the most common atmospheric composition of exoplanets?
That's a very interesting question. So there's one answer, which is what's the most common atmosphere that we've seen? And that's easy. That's atmosphere sort of like what Jupiter and Saturn have. They're mostly hydrogen and helium, the two most abundant elements in the universe. So if you're going to make a planet, they're the easiest thing to use in making it. Generally, everything is close to what Jupiter and Saturn look like. But that's also because those are the easiest atmospheres to find. They're the puffiest, they're the largest, they're the easiest to measure. The real frontier now is trying to push down to less puffy atmospheres, heavier atmospheres, something that's closer to like what the Earth has, we think. And there's a big discussion happening right now in the field about whether or not planets, small planets, keep this initial hydrogen helium atmosphere that we think all small planets should start out with, or if they lose that and they get what's called a secondary atmosphere that would be something closer like the Earth. And there are a lot of groups trying to hunt for those, but nobody's seen them yet. So we think a lot of planets should have atmospheres sort of like the Earth, but we haven't been able to detect those yet because they're so... the signal is so small.
And remind me again, a small planet, is, you mean small in comparison to what, Earth?
Or? Yeah, that's a real term of art, isn't it? Yeah, a small planet for me would be anything that's sort of 2 to 3 times the size of the Earth or smaller.
Okay.
Definitely the Earth falls into that category, but even something twice the size of the Earth would be small for us.
Yeah,
and hard to see.
Jim, you're agreeing with that?
Well, yeah, I'm just sort of thinking, as Thomas was saying earlier, we're relating, constantly relating things back to our own solar system,
yeah,
which is natural enough, right?
Sure.
And the massive planets tend to be the ones that where a larger fraction of their mass are gases and lighter elements, and we sometimes call the inner planets rocky planets, you know, because the bulk of the planet there is mineral and less volatile sorts of stuff. So that mass sort of leads into a distinction, well, a suspicion about overall composition, that if they're in the realm of the Earth mass, then maybe you're talking about a rocky planet. And if they're up at Jupiter mass, maybe you're talking about a gas giant planet, although I think that's yet to be established.
So those two extremes, I think we're pretty confident in. The fascinating thing is what happens in the middle.
Yeah.
Because there's this whole class, as we were just talking about, super Earths and sub Neptunes, that we see them, we know how big they are, but we have no idea what they look like from looking at planets in the solar system. So a lot of the work is something that's sort of halfway in between Earth and Neptune. Like, what does that even look like? We have no good signpost for it. And it probably is right on this boundary, as you were saying, Jim, between something that's mostly rock with just a thin sort of skein of atmosphere on it versus something that's, mostly gases and even some ice thrown in. It's a really fascinating area because it probably tells us a lot about planet formation, but we're still trying to just understand what these planets are made out of, so we can't quite get to the finish line yet.
I'm not sure if you brought this up, but you're looking for exoplanets in what is called hospitable zones. Is that right?
Habitable zones.
Ah, habitable.
Is that the first?
I thought it was hospitable.
It used to be called the Goldilocks zone. It's not too hot. It's not too cold.
I like the Goldilocks zone. I like that better. So I had it wrong to begin with. Hospitable, it was habitable.
Well, we could get it going. I feel like Goldilocks sort of fell out of favor because I think nobody felt it was technical enough. But we could get hospitable going. But yeah, the basic idea is that certainly for life on Earth, we need liquid water. That's one of the basic building blocks. So if we're looking at planets, one of the things we can work out besides just their sizes is how hot they are, how far away they are from their stars. So one of the things a lot of people are trying to find are planets about the size of the Earth that are at the right distance from their stars so that their temperatures, they could have liquid water on their surface. They're not too hot. They're not too cold. So those would be possibly habitable planets. And we actually know of about 2 dozen planets that are about the size of the Earth and at the right temperature that they could have water on their surface.
And there was, let's see, I'm reading here. There was a apparently some something in the news about from Cassandra about life being found.
Yeah, I think Thomas should talk about that. But right, that's been a lot of news just lately.
Yeah, somebody,
that's what everybody's looking for, right? So it's pretty exciting if somebody thinks they've found it, but then the scientists always have to debate this stuff.
I know. I feel like it's pretty difficult to win at a science, but I'm pretty sure if you found life off the Earth,
yeah,
you would win astronomy.
That's probably true.
Yeah. No, it has been in a ton of news. There's a planet called K2-18b. Again, it's sort of a telephone number, but it's a planet that is... So it's actually, it's a fascinating idea. It's not a planet like the Earth. It's a planet that's probably about like eight times heavier than the Earth and about 2.5 times larger. So it's much larger than the Earth. And we are trying to figure out what that atmosphere is like. And one of the ideas that people have had is that one way that atmosphere could work is it could be this sort of hydrogen helium atmosphere, like I was talking about. And underneath that, it has a liquid water ocean. Water is everywhere in the universe. And so it could be at the right temperature and pressure. It could be room temperature and room pressure, but it wouldn't be air like we're breathing. It would be hydrogen and helium. But that's okay. It's liquid water. It's at nice temperatures. And in principle, you could have life there. And so that seems possible with the observations we have. And so there's a team out of Cambridge University who have been trying to measure the atmosphere in more detail to try and detect gases that would be produced by life, like bacteria in the ocean. And the event 3 weeks ago was that they published a paper saying that they had detected gases that they thought came from life. So that's very exciting. But as Carl Sagan used to say, extraordinary claims do require extraordinary evidence. So
Jim's eyebrows went up with that one.
It's certainly right in this case.
Yes, it's a very big claim. And there's a bunch of discussion. The gas they were detecting, dimethyl sulfide, on Earth, it's a present in our atmosphere, and all of it is produced by like plankton from our oceans. But there's a lot of other ways to produce it in other chemistries and other atmospheres. So it doesn't have to come from life. And then there's also a lot of discussion about whether or not it's even there. So I was part of a team that wrote a, you know, what we call a rebuttal paper, pointing out that the statistics weren't quite right. You know, they were claiming that it was clearly there, but actually if you do some other checks, that sort of goes away. And that it turns out there are other gases, other molecules that could be doing this, and it doesn't have to be dimethyl sulfide. So it's certainly a possibility on this planet, and a lot of people are looking at it. And we as a field are 100% going to go back and hammer this thing and actually try and get to the bottom of it. But I think right now, one of my PhD professors used to ask people, how much money would you bet on it when somebody presented some science result to gauge how confident they were? Like, would you bet your house? Would you bet your car? Like, would you bet lunch money? I'm probably at about betting lunch money right now that this is really there. It's probably pretty low confidence. But if it is there, it's super exciting. But it's it was presented, I think, in a very strong way that was not warranted by the data.
I gotcha. You mentioned statistics, and that reminded me of a new Wisconsin Center for Origins Research, which is bringing together, I think it's called
WICOR,
multidisciplinary center. What's the background? Jim, do you know the background on it? Or
I do, but Thomas should certainly address that because he's one of the WICOR. One of the WICOR scientists.
Well, why don't you start and let him go?
So the Wisconsin Center for Origins Research. We've had a series, at least one series of speakers down at Space Place, invited scientists from WICOR, and just that variety of scientists tells you something. We've had astronomers like Thomas, but we've also had chemists And, well, we even had a mathematician at one point. There's a large number of different sorts of disciplines, and certainly people in the biological sciences, a large number of disciplines that all come together over this question that we were just talking about. Everybody wants to know, is there life elsewhere in the universe? And that's a complicated question. It involves science. There are science questions in all these different disciplines, but in nature, it doesn't conveniently divide up into the way we organize science departments at universities, right? You need to have these scientists from these different fields talking to each other and asking each other questions and sharing results and things like that. So Y-Core is a mechanism, a cross-disciplinary, cross-departmental initiative to keep those conversations, start those conversations, and make research programs that cross the disciplines happen. Is that fair?
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, the way I like to say it's like the Avengers of of trying to find life somewhere else in the universe. That they're assembling this team, because actually the K218 planet we were just talking about is a great example of this, because the people who announced that were astronomers through and through. Mm-hmm. And they're very good at knowing how to look at an exoplanet with a telescope. But then once you get that result, you need to really understand your statistics. You need to understand atmospheres and oceans and geology and biology in a way that as astronomers, we don't appreciate very well. And so to actually do this right and to know that once we've seen something, if we actually want to find life on another planet, and actually be confident that we're actually detecting it and seeing it, we can't just have astronomers involved. We need to have biologists and geologists and oceanographers and atmospheric scientists and everybody all pooling their subject matter expertise into getting at this, because it's going to be a very difficult problem that's going to require all of us working together to actually get traction on. And Y-Core is it's one of the only centers like this in North America. UW actually has a pretty unique set of skills that have allowed it to come together. So we're all very excited about it over the next couple of years. I think we have a real shot making real traction on this and have a real shot at, detecting life in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
So the origins, I just occurred to me, the origins go... you find life on planets, as far as we can tell, and you find planets around stars. So how do you get stars? How do you get planets? How do you get life? Those are the kinds of origins that we're talking about there. And those are some of those things are traditional astronomical topics. Astronomers mm-hmm. have tried to study how stars form. But then suddenly you start getting into, as we get into the planet formation and then what happens on planets, and if life is just interesting chemistry, how do you get that on what kinds of planets? Those are the origins that are in the Center for Origins Research, the core part of the Y-Core.
It's really cool. And here's a question or an email from Susan. I think it relates here in many ways. Susan emailed to ask why astronomers think there has to be water to support life on another planet. Might there possibly be a life form that is not water-based? Susan admits this question might reveal they watched too much Star Trek as a kid.
That's impossible. There's not too much Star Trek in anybody's life. Sad as a lifelong Trekker. Yeah, I mean, that's a super good question. That's actually a lot of people think about that. I mean, there are a lot of other candidates. Like, for one, one candidate for alternate biologies would be something like liquid methane, which is why a lot of people are excited about going to Titan, one of the moons of Saturn, because Titan has, the same way Earth has a hydrologic cycle, where we have oceans and clouds and rain and lakes, mm-hmm. With liquid water, Titan has the exact same thing, but it's all liquid methane. And so there's been one lander that landed on Titan and measured the surface, and NASA is actually in the process of building a helicopter that they're going to fly out to, well, carry out to Titan, drop into the atmosphere, and then that helicopter will fly around and explore the planet. So a lot of people are excited about that. As a practical matter, though, we only have one example of how life works. And so if we have to design these gigantic missions that are going to cost, you know, $3 billion to go try and find life around other planets, the baseline we're going to use is life like the Earth, because we know it works.
Yeah, we know what to look for.
Right. We know what to look for. We can design around that. And also, as a practical matter, if you're going to go to Congress and ask for several billion dollars, you need to show some sort of numbers that, you know, show you can do what you say you're going to do. And we can do that with life on Earth. But that's not to say people aren't thinking about it. We certainly are. It's just the only one we know works is life on Earth. So that's where we're starting.
I was thinking about the old Star Trek. The one Star Trek show that I remember that comes to mind is when they were on a new planet and they were walking among these rocks and trying to figure out where the life was, and the life was the rocks.
Was the rocks, yeah.
Yeah, the Horta episode.
Yeah.
I've seen all of Star Trek. I'm going to admit to you guys.
Yeah. We're in the same club.
Jim Lattice and Thomas Beatty, our guests today, as we talk space and exoplanets with him. And it's still time for you to join in. I see we have some more questions here. You can join in at 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking space today with our two guests, Jim Lattice, director of the UW Space Place, and Thomas Beatty, who is an assistant professor in the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy and somebody who studies exoplanets. It's great to have both of them with us. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Cassandra emailed to ask, would star clusters show the Big Bang was a chain reaction of multiple collisions because asteroids were spreading across the universe? That's an interesting thought.
Star clusters?
Would star clusters show the Big Bang was a chain reaction of multiple collisions?
I think no. But I'm not really following that too well. I mean, star clusters come out of star formation processes in the galaxy. Galaxies formed early in the universe, there were a lot of stages between the Big Bang and the kind of galaxies that form star clusters. Now, early star formation was probably different early in the universe after the Big Bang. So the processes have changed a lot, and chain reaction wouldn't really be how I would describe what goes on as the universe has evolved into being more chemically complex and more active in the way star formation works in galaxies. I shouldn't say more active, but just that processes change as galaxies mature. At least this is the current picture. I wouldn't use the word chain reaction, and I'm not quite sure how to fit asteroids in there either.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing to remember is that the universe that when it was first starting it wasn't like the universe today with empty space and then there was small, you know, stars and planets scattered throughout it. It was much smaller. The whole universe was hot. Everything was jammed together. And then it expanded and grew. So it really is close to a Big Bang rather than a chain reaction.
Mm-hmm. Todd in De Pere has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Todd.
Hi, good afternoon. My question is, of the known exoplanets, if there was intelligent life on any of them, would we be able to detect any type of radio waves or any other type of wave or communication from that distance?
Hmm. Yeah.
That's something that a bunch of people, Todd, are thinking very strongly about. It's there's a whole field now called technosignatures. The way we like to call searching for life is looking for biosignatures. So we now talk about technosignatures or SETI to try and search for that. Radio waves are, it turns out, maybe a little bit tougher. Because if you think about, well, actually the radio that you're probably listening to right now, you know, WPR does not want to be broadcasting radio waves into space where nobody's going to be listening, at least not immediately. So the radio, you know, most broadcast radio tries to transmit at the ground. One of the main radio sources that actually on Earth that transmits into space would be missile warning radars. So there's some thought about that. Certainly, there have been searches for radio waves for the last 50 or 60 years, and we haven't detected anything, which really just means there's nobody really nearby transmitting. But there are other ways of detecting intelligent life. I've written about how we could, with next-generation telescopes, be able to detect city lights on the night sides of planets like the Earth with next-generation telescopes. Because it turns out if you look at the Earth from the night, it's not dark. There's a whole bunch of cities that you can see. And people have also looked at, now that we've been able to measure atmospheres, detecting industrial pollutants in planetary atmospheres. And that's a little tougher. Probably if you could see industrial pollution in a planetary atmosphere, it would not be a great place to visit. It would be some sort of like WALL-E planet. I don't know if you guys know WALL-E. That's a current reference.
Yeah, the movie.
Yeah. It wouldn't be a great place to visit, but that would be another way. So there are a lot of ways we could think about this, and people are trying, but it's hard. Even with all we've done to the Earth, we still haven't really affected it that much on a global scale.
Hmm. Would human life be different? I'm reading this email off. Would be different if we lived on a larger planet that still has a rocky core? I imagine gravity would be a factor.
I guess we'd all be a lot shorter and stouter or something.
That's right. More gravity. Be interesting if there was no moon and there were no tides. The moon, it turns out, we think might be a pretty rare event because the moon was formed when a planet about the size of Mars hit the Earth very early on. And then part of that got blown off into space and formed the moon. And if that's a rare event, then it seems like most planets like the Earth wouldn't have a really large moon like we do.
Yeah, and well, what's the? And you said there'd be a problem if we didn't have the moon.
Oh well, we wouldn't have tides, and it's hard to say. But there's some thought that one of the ways that life on Earth arose was all the oceans mixing because of tides from the moon. So if we didn't have the moon and the tides were a lot smaller, that might have not allowed things to mix as well and maybe not let life evolve. But that's very, as I said, I would not put a lot of money on that. There's so much we don't understand about how life was formed on the Earth initially that's very conjectural.
Yeah, so and the moon notwithstanding, there's no reason why something more massive than the Earth, I'll just say double twice the mass of the Earth, that the same sorts of processes might not be happening on the Earth that would lead to life. So it's hard to say how our lives would be different because you don't really know what. There's a lot of other things. Do other planets have plate tectonics, which dramatically affects the chemistry of the soil and the atmosphere? And right here in our solar system, we have an Earth-sized planet, Venus, that doesn't have plate tectonics like the Earth does. And trying to understand that, and that's where a lot of the geology sorts of questions are going to come in. We have enough variety in our own solar system that we need to study that and try to understand how these planets work. And in order to have a context for when we learn more about these exoplanets and what might be possible out there.
And what's your big hope here for your next find, Thomas?
Our big hope? Every day we're finding new planets, new small ones. UW owns time on a telescope out in Arizona called WIN. The W in WIN is Wisconsin. So we're finding new planets, and we're using telescopes like the James Webb Space Telescope to try and measure their atmospheres. Like I said, I think we have a real good shot with WICOR and the team we've assembled there at making a run at detecting life, or at least finding a planet like the Earth around another star in the next 5 to 10 years.
So planets going around stars reminds me that, of course, the Earth goes around the sun once a year. And I've just been handed a note here that says that today is... the Earth has been one time around the sun since the last time you had a birthday. So, happy birthday, Larry.
birthday from us to you.
Oh, boy. Yeah, it's been many revolutions. I can tell you that.
We're not asking.
And thanks, guys, for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
It's been a lot of fun. Thomas Beatty and Jim Lattice of the UW Space Place. Thomas, a professor, and I'm Larry Mueller, and I'm a birthday boy today. Thanks for listening.